listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Sit back and please enjoy Dear One.
From 1953 to 1967, One published the first openly gay and lesbian periodical in the United States. The magazine reached several thousand readers each month, a great many of them isolated and in search of community. In larger cities, the magazine was available on newsstands. In smaller towns, it arrived in mailboxes in a simple, unmarked envelope. Many readers wrote back to One. These are their voices.
October 1953, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dear One, the following you might call my credo. I believe in homosexuality as a way of life. I feel no sense or guilt of shame. I feel no sense of guilt or shame. I know that I, as a homosexual, can be an asset to the community in which I live and a good citizen of the land which gave me birth, realizing that others may not understand my way of life and that they may seek to deprive me of my social and civil rights, I can still say with all sincerity, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I affirm my undying conviction in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the immortality of the soul. I pledge my utmost to the task of securing equal rights for those of my people who merit and desire it. I abhor any form of totalitarianism which seeks to enslave the spirit of man. I pray that the injustices and misunderstandings of our people will soon be a thing of the past. I believe that no nobler bond of affection exists than that love which unites the hearts of two men. With these ideals, I know that I can be a happy, satisfied, well-integrated individual whose life will merit the respect of mankind. No name published.
Mm-hmm. October 1953, Santa Monica. Dear One, I've been a great follower of your magazine. However, I am a civil service worker, and at the risk of my job, as a bad security risk, I must refrain from giving you my name. In government circles, I hear talk of the magazine as being subversive. The government seems very much in favor of the way you approach the problem of homosexuality. But since the magazine has not required its staff and members to sign loyalty oaths, it will remain in danger of being declared subversive by the Senate investigating groups. If you sign loyalty oaths, success in your undertaking may not be far off. Many civil service employees would then sympathize with you. They believe the government would take a different attitude toward this minority group if the group stood firmly against the communist infiltration of this country. Making them citizens, this country could be proud to have. No name published.
February 1953, Los Angeles. Dear One, I am a physician on the staff of the UCLA Medical School. Your article in the January 1953 issue, pages 8 and 9, implies that research on homosexuality is now being conducted at UCLA. This is misleading. The study now in progress concerns antisocial sex behavior involving acts of violence and attacks on minors. Homosexuality per se is not an essential part of this problem, and therefore does not form a specific part of this investigation. I have discussed your magazine with those involved in this research, and you will, I am sure, be interested to learn that the law-abiding, socially useful homosexual is rapidly becoming of little legal interest, and prosecution of this large group is being discouraged throughout the state. For the first time, a distinction is being made. Attention is being directed only to those who by force violate the freedoms of others for sexual reasons. The well-adjusted homosexual is considered as separate from this group as the usual heterosexual. I am sure you will agree this is great progress. However, there remains the tremendous prejudice of the surrounding heterosexual world against something they cannot understand. This prejudice is based on lack of facts regarding homosexuality. The unfortunate part of it is that science does not have any substantial explanation of this constantly recurring natural phenomenon. One of the reasons has been the failure on the part of homosexuals themselves to recognize this lack and to do something positive about it in an organized way. If you do not produce the necessary data, it is unlikely that anyone else will. You may print all or part of this letter with signature if you wish. Sincerely, Philip M. West, M.D.
September 16th, 1954, Miami. Dear One, are you aware of the degree of persecution that homosexuals in Miami, Florida have been subjected to in the past 6 weeks? I assume you have read in some of your press. It all began with the murder of an Eastern Airlines steward, William Simpson, on August 9th of this year. The enclosed newspaper clippings show briefly the state of affairs that has developed. In politics, from the local level all the way up to the state, it is popular to yell war on homosexuals, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry is jumping on the bandwagon. Eastern Airlines is conducting a private investigation of homosexuality, which has already caused the resignation of a considerable number of its stewards. My reason for writing you is this, that I, with others, am ready to fight back. However, I do not want my efforts to be futile and wasted. I have read several of your publications and remember that you sent a representative to New York to help in organizational work. The situation in Miami is a challenge to every homosexual in America, and I trust that we will, in a concerted move, make our voices heard all over the land. Yours is the only source of leadership I know. I believe I could get as many as 50 people together for an organizational meeting if I could get some help or leadership. Please answer me promptly. Hopefully, Charlie.
October 30th, 1954, Washington, D.C. Dear One, enclosed is my check number 347 in the amount of $3.25, which is for the sale by Bill's Smoke Shop, 9th Street, near F. Northwest, of the 25 copies of the October 1954 issue of One. 6 cents per copy were retained by both Bill and myself as our commission. Bill talked as though the 25 copies sold out rather fast. I asked him if he would like to have 50 of the November issue, and he indicated that he would. I inquired if he had had any complaints as to its legality on the newsstand. He said that if I really wanted to know whether it was legal, I would have to see Roy Blick. Blick has been on the vice squad of the Washington Metropolitan Police Department for many years and confiscates through his police power certain magazines and books. For example, I saw the nudist magazine Sunshine and Health on newsstands in Los Angeles when I was there in June, but that magazine, according to Bill, is illegal on the newsstands in Washington. I certainly have no intention of contacting Blick on the matter and would not recommend anybody contact him, as he is a very ferocious type of person and the one who trains the plainclothesmen here to solicit homosexuals in parks and theaters. Since Wyoming Senator Lester Hunt committed suicide, Blick has quieted down on the homosexual issue, and very little appears in the newspapers anymore about homosexual morals cases. One of Blick's detectives, as you may know, entrapped the senator's son in Lafayette Park about a year ago, and Lester Jr. was convicted. Then Senator McCarthy threatened to damage Hunt's chances of getting reelected to the Senate by exposing the story to Hunt's constituents. McCarthy's act was essentially political, since Hunt was a Democrat and McCarthy is a Republican. I am telling you these things so that you can form a more intelligent decision on whether to send me the 50 copies of the November issue. If One wishes to send them, I will deliver them to Bill's, just as I did the October issue. Sincerely yours, Brad.
April 24th, 1955, a San Francisco suburb. Dear One, ever since discovering that your magazine could be purchased locally, I have been reading it regularly, beginning with the October issue of last year. At that time, I was in favor of subscribing immediately, but held back after discussing the matter with a European-born friend of mine, an ex-Nazi refugee. He advised against it, fearing that they might get a copy of the list. Fear being the contagious thing that it is, I refrained, knowing that I could purchase it locally. The magazine is beginning to mean so much to me, every issue I have read, from cover to cover. The more I read, the more firmly convinced I have become that the time is ripe for an attempt to campaign for acceptance in society. Ever since the Grand Inquisitor from Wisconsin got underway, I have strongly resented the implication that because of what I am also a traitor to my country, if not an avowed communist. The distance between nonconformity and treason is infinite, and frankly, I cannot see any homosexual with a degree of intelligence embracing communism. Feeling the way that I do, I've come to the conclusion that it is far better to make an earnest attempt to alter the situation rather than going in for passive resignation and saying it cannot be done. Benjamin Franklin, I believe, once made the statement that if we do not hang together, we shall surely hang separately. And the climate of this country is such that this could very well apply to our own minority group. Well, it's high time I brought this to a close. Let's keep on with the struggle, because any progress is far better than none at all. Very sincerely, George.
August 1955, New York City. Dear One, you're doing, basically, a good job. Though I'd like a little more fiction. And a little less esoteric hogwash. My wife and I enjoy reading One, and we're only sorry that we can't leave the magazine out in plain sight in the apartment. No name published.
October 1955, Santa Barbara. To all you men. I just read your magazine for the first time, and I want to tell you how horrible you all are. You know very well that all homosexuals are men, and there are not any women homosexuals. How dare you have a feminine viewpoint section when the only feminine viewpoint comes from feminine men? I see lots of homo men, but never in my life have I seen a homo woman. I'll bet that writer Ann Carl Reed is a man, and you're just trying to fool the public. Why don't you leave women alone and out of your lousy magazine? You don't have any respect. Signed, Mrs. B.
March 1956, Perth Amboy, New Jersey. Dear One, it is unnecessary to tell you I enjoy your magazine, but I do wish you would print more material covering and appealing to the female sex. Out of the 34 letters printed in the letters department, only 4 are from women. It is quite obvious that most of One's readers are males. That's understandable, since your articles cover mostly the male homosexual and the heroes in your fiction are male. No doubt you have a few female readers too, but I am sure you could have more if only you would include the women regularly in your issues. People enjoy reading about individuals with which they can identify. But it is difficult for a woman to identify with a man, and vice versa. The issue I most enjoyed was the one devoted entirely to the female. But why have just an occasional issue for women? I'm sure you're not prejudiced against us. There must be many who feel this way, so please, don't neglect us. Signed, Miss A.
July 11th, 1956, a medium-sized town near Montreal, Canada. Dear One, I read the other night at my girlfriend's home your strong article in favor of us, whereby we should have the same rights as the homos have. I am 29 now, and I've been a lesbian for many years, having had my first experience in a nudist camp while in Europe with my husband in 1947. We still live together, and he does not mind one bit my way of thinking about love for lovely feminine friends. On the contrary. However, here in this part of North America, especially in this province, it is very difficult to get together and live together, as our laws are very strict. It is impossible for us to receive one, and I am writing you this note to find out if you have a way that I can receive your interesting magazine without its being refused by the postal inspector. By sending same one first-class mail, will it reach me here? I do not know if this is possible, but could you also pass along my name and address to someone you would know that would be interested in exchanging correspondence with this writer? As I would very much like corresponding with American lesbians my age. Trusting to hear from you, yours very sincerely, Megan.
December 13th, 1957, a medium-sized town in southern Wisconsin. Dear One, I'm wondering if there is a drug that will control or dull my homosexual desires. I took Miltown, a tranquilizer, some time ago, and it seemed that while I was under this drug, that my homosexual desires and drives were decreased. Now that I've stopped taking it, my drives are building up again as bad as ever. Will drinking lessen my desires? I'm so lonesome and blue, and I'm ever looking for a partner to strike a romance with. I even cry over it. Would you advise me to find a partner with whom I can show my love and affections to, go on suffering the rest of my life, or find some drug that may help me? I'd seen a psychiatrist some time ago, and of all people to fall in love, I fell in love with him. But not he with me. Now he's moved to another town, and I miss him so. I dream of him continually, and I wake up to find it's only a dream. What shall I do? Please let me hear from you. Thank you. As ever, Harold.
December 1957, San Francisco. Dear One, an opinion expressed by Mr. A.C. of Galveston, Texas, did make me so damn mad that I would like to answer him. Women who are lesbians try to be as inconspicuous as possible, for the most part, not because we are ashamed, but merely because it is easier to get along in this world when considered normal. When a man is pointed out as being gay, he receives one glance. A woman receives a second and a third. Is it any wonder, then, we prefer to keep quiet? Signed, Miss L.
January 9th, 1958, Los Angeles. Dear One, I learned of your magazine from Donald Webster Corey's book, The Homosexual in America. I bought my first copy today and read every word with great eagerness. However, the name One alone repels me. It is filled with such awful loneliness. Would you be kind enough to advise me on what could be done about a threat to expose me as homosexual to my employer? I have been promoted to management level, and I know my reputation is such that no one would believe my coworker. Yet, it does worry me. Enclosed, find money for a subscription and a small contribution to the magazine. Please do not publish my letter. Thank you, Marion.
May 1958, Brooklyn. Dear One, I read your magazine every month with the greatest interest. Believe me, it is extremely difficult for the average woman to find congenial people. I wish someone would open a club. I believe that older women would appreciate this. The usual bars for lesbians are frequented by teenagers, as far as I can determine. An older woman without a companion feels something like an old granny, and very much out of place. I have written two novels about the homosexual woman and feel that my books are true to life, realistic, and interesting. That is, to the average lesbian. I do not pull that old switch at the end where, in most gay books, the one girl goes off with a man, thus settling the problem of her homosexuality for once and for all. This is, to me, so much whitewash to satisfy the heterosexual reader, to soothe them into feeling that the world isn't so bad after all, and that when these bad homosexual things do occur, they always come out right in the end. My novels contain no such lulling conclusions. Signed, Miss J.
May 22nd, 1958, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Dear One, last week history repeated itself. Another One magazine was stopped at the customs office and labeled prohibited. Obviously, using the different sender's address of box 15692 LA didn't fool the customs clerks either. I had a good mind to grab the magazine from the clerk's hands, but of course that wouldn't do. I guess I'll never see these issues now. I'm even more curious as to what devilish things could be printed in them. Now that one is forbidden fruit, it makes it that much more in demand. Anyway, to keep one magazines from the post office fires in Canada, I'd like you to mail the mags to a friend of mine in Chicago, where I hope to spend a short vacation this August. Needless to say, I'm very sorry about the Canadian situation. Best regards, Stephen.
June 1958, Brooklyn, New York. Dear one, you were downright cruel to Miss S of Sydney, Australia, and Mr. B of Hartford, Connecticut. Don't you realize these are two lonely, unhappy kids? Why can't you run a series of human interest articles that would bring some kind of help to them? Your articles are very ethical, very informative, but they are as cold as hell. The kids want warmth, and one hasn't got it. You are advancing our cause as nothing else has been able to do. You're showing us that we're not alone and that others have the same problems. However, your magazine is aimed specifically at people who think, not people who feel. And I don't believe the human brain really begins to operate before the age of 40. The kids are emoting, not thinking. And then when you do emote, you give the already forlorn kids something like, rest shall I never, haunted forever, pitied, a pest. Does this help? Let's have some courageous writing. Let's have some chin-up stuff. I certainly would like to see a note of optimism in one. I see homosexuality as a wonderful way of life. I certainly rest. I am not hunted. I hope I am not a pest. Signed, Miss W.
July 1958, North Island, New Zealand. Dear one, I'm an old man now. I've craved affection for 74 years. I crave affection more than sex, but believe me, both desire and performance are possible and extremely delightful at 74. I've never run around looking for sex, but I've often looked into a man's eyes and desired to love him. I've been in love with a man many years and never even spoken to him. Such is the torture of the law in this country and yours. They talk of British justice. There's no justice if a man is a homosexual. Our doctors don't understand this at all and don't want to, nor do our lawyers. They call us perverts. What rot. What God made us, so shall we remain until death. I'm married, thinking love for a woman might grow. What a fool I was. How could it? For a homosexual man to marry a woman as I did is wrong and against God. He'd made me that I should love men and want a man's affection, and I sinned when I married. You may think that at 74, one has no strong desire. Be both disillusioned and encouraged. Desire, I believe, lives till a man's last breath is out. Anyway, desire in me still lives strongly. It is hard and perhaps stupid to put up the fight I do, to remain outwardly respectable and within the law. Signed, Mr. C.
March 1960, New York City. Dear sir, or should I say she, I happened to come across this magazine today. I found it in his belongings. There's no doubt about it. I have a brother who is homosexual, and I hate his guts for it. He never tried to pull anything on me, and better not. I read one of his queer magazines and think whoever publishes it and everyone who reads it has to be a queer. I think the stuff you write in those books is a bunch of BS. I met a few homos not too long ago. They tried to take advantage of me. I got in a struggle with two of them. I had a chain and wrapped it around both of their queer necks. That's how I feel about fairies, queers, homos, whatever you want to call them. How can a man have sex with another man? I'll never know, and I don't want to know. Same for women. If I ever meet up with any more, I'll use my .38 on them. That's what they deserved. Signed, a straight guy. Oh, P.S. I'll expose all you queers. Ha ha.
23 August, 1960. A small town in central Pennsylvania. Dear one, I was dismissed from the Army after 16 years. I was accused of and pleaded guilty to several acts of homosexuality. The two fellows I had my relations with enjoyed the experience. Needless to say, I did too. However, someone reported me, and the two fellows got scared into making statements. I pleaded guilty in order to avoid a lot of embarrassment for me and my friends. I was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge and 1 year at Fort Leavenworth. Everyone was amazed at the deal I got, inasmuch as I had an outstanding military record. I have the Silver Star, the Purple Heart, and 11 battle stars. I served in World War II and twice in Korea during combat, and had outstanding units as a first sergeant. My behavior was strictly non-aggressive and had no effect on my efficiency or the efficiency of my company. I got out of the disciplinary barracks on 8 July of this year, after 9 months. I am now out of the Army, out of a job, out of circulation, and most of all, I'm out of my male nude photos, which I miss terribly. I destroyed the photos to keep the investigators from using them as evidence against me. I could have gotten 5 to 10 years. So I wonder, would you do me a favor? I live in a very small town, and as far as I can find out, there are no kindred souls near. Could you send me some addresses of nude photo outlets? Or maybe some pictures to get me started. I enjoyed reading the copy of one which you so generously sent. In this small town, 95% Catholic, I couldn't risk subscribing. I'll have to wait until I can get a job somewhere away from here. I sure would repay you if you can do anything for me. So long, Dan.
April 22nd, 1962, a medium-sized town in central New York. Dear one, I'm a young man, 24, now finishing my last year at college. The truth is, I have been longing for homosexual contacts since I was 11 or 12, but up until a few weeks ago, never had such contact, barring a few early adolescent experiences. This recent experience was with a young semi-prostitute in New York. The strata of homosexual life that I've touched upon in New York seems connected with criminality, prostitution, fear, and extortion. I have the feeling that this must be the kind of gay life that corresponds to a similar side of heterosexual life that is by no means representative. Please don't think I'm saying this from snobbishness. Unfortunately, I'm all too attracted by this drifting life, and I'm afraid of it. As one friend of mine put it, these guys seem like losers all around. Perhaps my question should be phrased, must one be an all-around social loser if one wishes to live a homosexual life in our society? What I really want to know is whether there is no other way to meet people other than in 8th Avenue bars or by hanging around Times Square. I should add here that I'm planning to go into psychoanalysis next year, largely to find out this underlying cause of this aberration. I am not one of those who try to insist that seeking homosexual relations is as normal as heterosexual love. I feel I could be much happier without it. If nothing else, your magazine has seemed to me the proof that we can be well-balanced, creative, reasonable, and mature members of society, for you must surely be such people to put out such a magazine. Your friend, Russell.
August 27th, 1960, Los Angeles, California. Dear one, in your August issue, your articles on homosexual servicemen were exquisite. I entered the service when I was 17, and I was discharged at 19 because of being a homosexual. I was given a UD, undesirable discharge, also known as a gay discharge. I, of course, thought my life was ruined. I didn't know how I was going to explain away the years on my job sheet. Well, I got a hold of myself and found that by using the excuse of school, I could make out quite well until I had a job or two under my belt. To explain away the 4F draft card, I said I had a bad back, which no one could prove different. I am now 23 and in a management position in a small company here in Los Angeles. I have met quite a number of young men who have gay discharges. Most have stopped worrying about their discharge and done something for themselves. But there are still some who are afraid to try and get away from the past and look towards the future. I'll grant that with a discharge, you can't work for the government or civil service. But there are plenty of jobs that don't ask for service records. The War Department should know by now that it can't rid homosexuals from the service. As long as they don't cause trouble, let them be. Many good men have been discharged. A friend of mine who was a WAC told me, the WACs never ask who's gay in the barracks, but who's straight. There are a number of doctors and lawyers who lobby in Washington for us. Let's get behind them and get a few of our laws changed so a homosexual doesn't have to be afraid of who he is or what his sexual need might be. Signed, Pat.
March 3rd, 1963, a suburb of Detroit. Dear One, after having read many of your interesting and informative magazines, I finally decided to write and attempt a thank you note. To be able to help the world to understand that the homosexual is as human as any next door neighbor is a tremendous task. However, I think you're going great. I've read that down through history, many of our own very important writers, historians, generals, and the like have been homosexual. And in some places in the Bible, there are hints that Jesus himself was soft and feminine. How true this is, I cannot attest to, even though I've read the Bible through and through. You see, I am an ordained minister and have had to study it. I've given counsel to many of the gay set and find that letting them decide for themselves is always the best answer to their problems. If they are gay, so what? As long as they can make useful citizens of themselves and do not become a hindrance to the so-called normal set. I almost believe I hate that word normal. What is normal? What is abnormal? To be different in one's way of thinking about sex is supposed to be the unforgivable sin. And I say that it's not for us to play God. Love has no boundaries. To have found true love in friendship in male to female or male to male or female to female is the one thing that God intended us to do. All things to me are meant, or they would not happen as they do. I have had many men come to me with a problem of being in love with one of their own kind, and have also indulged in this practice myself. I have found that the true, honest homosexual is kind, considerate, temperate, tolerant, extremely intelligent, and on the whole, more than a true citizen in any community. I therefore say you are on the right track. I believe you have made great strides in the one thing that we need in this country, the right to free thinking, free loving, and the true freedom of doing and performing that which is best suited to our individual feelings, out in the open or in the privacy of our own homes. In God's name, I bless you. Very truly, Reverend Jean.
August 2nd, 1963, Omaha, Nebraska. Dear One, I know you can't answer my question, but how does one find love? The one time in my life I tried to make friends with a man that attracted me, he worked for the same company that I did. I'm certain that I attracted him too, but he seemed to lead me on and then reject me. I was quite naive then. I was eventually fired, but in the meantime, I went through such severe persecution that my health was destroyed, both physically and mentally. Finally, my parents asked me to come home and enter a mental hospital, which I did. After I left the hospital, and as soon as the doctor said I was ready, I wrote to many companies concerning employment, and a fine company in Omaha decided to hire me. I hope I shall never give them cause to regret their decision. One good result of all this, I am better able to accept myself as I am, and to realize that it is men rather than girls that attract me. A bad result is that the one time in my life I tried to find love, I met with complete rejection. I know I can live without sex, since I've done so all my life, but few men can live without love, and I am not one of these men. Sincerely yours, Greg.
26 November, 1963, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dear friends, the article entitled The Inquisition in the November issue had a profound effect on me. Little wonder, though, as I once found myself in the same situation. I have always been a sort of sitting duck for these types of inquisitions. I guess it is because I am considered to be too beautiful for a boy. And I'm constantly being taunted and suspected by witch hunters. And believe me, we have them here in Florida. I have learned to live with it, though. And unlike the poor soul in the story who hadn't the backbone to fight for his rights, I'd like to meet the SOB who could force any confession out of me. I will fight to my dying day for my rights as an American citizen, which in my opinion include the right to go to bed with whomever I please. Sincerely, Barry Ross. P.S. You can print my name. I have nothing to hide and do not lead a double life.
January 24, 1964, a suburb of Los Angeles. Dear One, I just read your December issue of One, my first encounter with your magazine. On page 20, you spoke of homosexual meetings. Do you know where these meetings are held in the San Fernando Valley? I live north of Ventura and west of Topanga. I am 17 and very interested in receiving help. At present, I live off physique magazines consisting of nude photos of men and showers after PE class, where I have several favorite lovers. I have never told anyone I was homosexual, but I feel that through your organization, I may find satisfaction for my sexual hunger. I am a Christian, and so are my parents and family. They must never find out because they would worry about my life after death. I don't know if you arrange for lovers, but I'd like to tell you my statistics and what I want in a man. I am 5'11", 130 pounds, thin but well-proportioned, attractive, not feminine but not real masculine. I'm a virgin. I want a man 17 to 35, 5'6 to 6'2, 150 pounds to 215, but not a 5'6 man of 215 pounds. Large chest and arms, muscular, large thighs, and a fat rump. Not too fat, but fat enough so it looks tempting in tight pants. A manly, masculine face. It doesn't have to be at all handsome, just masculine. I don't care what kind of cock. I guess I'm asking for a lot, but that's it. Enclosed is a self-addressed stamped envelope for your reply. I'm so thankful for your magazine, which has given me new hope. Yours, Mr. M. Phil.
March 3rd, 1964, Columbus, Ohio. Dear One, I've always meant to write, but never had the necessary impetus before. I lived in Los Angeles almost all my life. My parents were there, and I had many gay friends. I have a good profession and achieved success in my field at a very young age, but my parents, friends, and career could not make up for a great lack that I had always felt. I met a young man, a sailor, who came to LA on leave. The first time I met him, I knew I was hooked. I saw him on all his subsequent leaves and fell deeply in love with him. He was an unusually fine boy, and I couldn't deny what I felt for him. There came a time when his duty in the Navy was finished and he was to return home. I had to make one of the biggest decisions of my life, and I did. I gave up my possessions, my job, my family, my friends, and the sunny climate of California and returned with him to the snow and ice of Ohio. I love him very much, and we have grown ever closer. I see his family often, and they have become an important part of my life. My young man is adjusting nicely to civilian life and is working hard in a good position. We have a wonderful group of friends here, many of whom are partners and have been together for several years. We are young. I am 24, he's 23, but have no fear of the future. There is nothing that cannot be discussed between us. I'm glad I've waited until I could write you a happy letter. Enclosed is a check for a year's subscription and also a small contribution. You have given me courage and strength over the years, far more than you can ever know. Sincerely, Trent.
November 16th, 1964, Baltimore, Maryland. Dear One, I don't know if you get letters from people with a real big problem or if you can help them, but I do know I need help and you're my last hope. It's going to be hard to put my problem into writing, but I'll try. You see, outwardly, I'm a woman, but inside I have a male's emotions. In fact, at times, I'm two different people. For while I'm a woman and even act like one, and then all of a sudden I'm a man. This change doesn't show on the outside, only on the inside. I never know when this change is going to happen, it just does. Only one fact remains permanent. I have no love or emotions for men. I only fall in love with other girls. Here in Baltimore, there's a place called Cicero's where lesbians hang out. Since I don't consider myself a lesbian, I don't go there and try and pick up some girl. I want another girl's company, but I won't look for it. She's got to come to me because she wants to, or else it's a no-go. I don't think someone should be forced to live or associate with someone who isn't normal. Right now, I'm about so darn lonely I could scream. I've tried to take my life twice in the past 3 years. Sometimes I get so depressed, I can't bear to go on. I work in an office because I prefer filing to factory work, although I know others like me prefer working where they can wear pants. My work is okay because they accept me and they don't know what my problem is. If they found out, I could get fired, as I have been before. It tears me up inside when the fellows in the outer office come into the filing department, goof off with the other girls I work with, hugging them or patting them. It tears me apart because I realize that I have no one. No one at all. And I never will. I will never marry and experience married life. Men and I get along as they just talk to me. But if they get fresh, my masculine side shows through and there's trouble. There's only one fellow in my whole office that talks to me, and he's like a brother to me. It's the only feeling I get for men. I can't go on living without love and affection. I want to know, A, if you get letters from other girls with the same sort of problem. B, if you know of any who might live pretty close to me. And C, if you know someone who doesn't have my problem, but who would like to be friends with me. I guess this is a lonely hearts letter, but you are my last hope. I'll enclose my address and phone number so that if there is someone that you know, they can get in touch with me. I'll be waiting anxiously to hear from you or someone who might be able to bring a little happiness into my life. Sincerely yours, Lori.
June 8th, 1964, West Chester, Pennsylvania. Dear one, I have been in this prison nearly a month now, with at least 4 months more to go until I have a trial, all simply because I cannot afford bail or an attorney. I have lost everything, family, friends, job, probably even the house I was purchasing. I would not bother seeking help or sympathy if I were guilty of any crime, but the truth is the charges against me are completely false. I am waiting to be indicted on assault and solicitation to commit sodomy, when in reality it was I who was solicited and I who was assaulted. My letter will be censored, so I don't know how much I can tell you. Over 3 weeks ago, I went to Westchester via bus from Philadelphia with Darren Wilcox, whom I had been living with for a year, and with whom I was purchasing the house. We wanted to visit some college friends before the summer vacation. We spent Saturday afternoon at the college here, then decided to take the train back home. While we were walking to the station, a group of college kids called us over to the car in which they were sitting. "Hey, do you guys want cock?" one of them said. The boys then said if we wanted what they had to offer, we would have to pay for it. They asked us how much money we had. Darren said we were broke and had to catch a train anyhow. Then they drove up about a half a block and stood waiting for us on the sidewalk. They refused to let us pass. One of them punched me in the stomach and kicked me in the face. Darren yelled for the police. Finally, the guys left, and Darren and I ran to the train station, where we were picked up by the police and taken to headquarters. It seems the hustlers realized the seriousness of what they had done and told the police that it was Darren and I who had solicited them. Consequently, we are waiting in this prison. We won't be appointed a lawyer for several months, and then it will be a half-interested public defender. Things look very grim. My family never wants to see me again. There is no one Darren and I can turn to for help. Then I remembered one. It was worth a try, if only to tell someone where we are and why we are here, even if only to have someone on the outside worry about us. But what we are really hoping for is help to fight this. With financial and legal assistance, Darren and I could prove our innocence. We will gladly submit to any lie detector test or truth serum in order to prove that we did not assault or solicit anyone. I can only beg that you will do anything possible to help us. I never really believed that minority groups in this country were oppressed. Now I know better. Please, sir. Richard.
January 25th, 1965, Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. It's a follow-up letter. Dear One, last year in May, my lover and I were arrested in Chester County and detained there for approximately 90 days to await trial. While we were there, Richard, my lover, wrote a letter to you explaining that we had neither lawyer nor ready cash to pay one. You were kind enough to get in touch with the Janus Society in Philadelphia, who in turn procured for us a very good attorney that handled our case on credit. We were released on a writ of habeas corpus without having to go through trial. At the hearing, our attorney stated that the state's witness is the one that should have been in our position, and the judge concurred. Bob and I did not, and are not, pressing charges. Thank you very much for your assistance in this case. Without your help, we would probably still be awaiting trial without legal counsel. Please let us know the cost to you for your communication with the Janus Society so that we can send you a contribution in excess of your cost. Thank you again, and please keep up your good work in the homophile movement. You and the Janus Society surely have two active supporters. Sincerely yours, Darren.
Dear One.
Dear One.
Dear One.
Dear One.
Dear One.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, I'm going to introduce you. Thank you. Thank you so very much. I'm so delighted to see everyone here. I'd like to introduce to you our cast. Mr. Paul Jasek.
Yay.
Miss Dalila Ali Raja. Miss Beverly Mickens. Yeah. And Mr. Hunter Lee Hughes. Woo! Thank you also to our engineers, yeah. Elisa and Russell.
Thank you. Woo!
To the Library Foundation for inviting us.
Yes. Thank you.
And especially Miss Sarah Charlton, who assisted us all the way down the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Zsa-Zsa.
You're very welcome, sir.
So, once again, good afternoon, everyone. It's great to have so many folks here, and thanks for spending the afternoon with us. I'm the director of One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California. I also teach there. We're the largest LGBTQ archive in the world, and we're right here in Los Angeles, so if you didn't know about us, you should come and find out. We're also the longest continually running organization in the United States that's LGBTQ. In fact, these letters were written by the magazine that we began publishing in 1953, and we're still running, and we're still doing all kinds of stuff, including programs like this. So we survived. In addition, I'm really happy today that we've heard some history, but instead of it being the usual kind of history that has lots and lots of facts, no offense, Craig, and lots and lots of dates and things to remember. This is a history of an affective history, a history of people's feelings and emotions that I think are seldom shared. And it's a really wonderful thing to be able to hear people's voices from the past in these ways. So I think it's fantastic. And it's also the nascence of the gay and lesbian civil rights movement in a way that you can't approach it by just reading a book. These wonderful letters really bring to life how people felt in the time. So let's have another round of applause, please, for Zsa Zsa Gerszek and for the actors.
Thank you.
And let me also introduce you to Craig Lofton, who's a professor at Cal State Fullerton. Craig is the noted editor of Letters to One, Gay and Lesbian Voices from the 1950s and 1960s. And the letters that you heard were originally compiled by him from the One Archives. And he's also written the author of a book called Masked Voices, Gay Men and Lesbians in Cold War America. So I'm going to ask Craig to start us off, and then I'm going to open up and talk. He and Zsa Zsa will speak to you a little bit about the context of this, and then I'd like to open it up, if I may, to questions from you all, and so be thinking about what you might want to ask. So, Craig, first of all, can you talk about how you first became involved with One and how you found the letters and how that all came about?
Okay. Can you hear me? I was starting my graduate program at USC in the history department and fishing around for dissertation. And I wasn't familiar with the One Archives. I was interested in McCarthyism and the Cold War and the paranoia of the time. And this was about 2000, and a lot of new research was just coming out showing the impact on gays and lesbians, especially in the government. So I was kind of curious more broadly. So I just went to One looking for 50s stuff. You know, knowing this was an organization that went back to then, just looking for, you know, I was originally planning to do something on the magazine, but then I unexpectedly found the letters. The archive didn't even know they had them. They were unprocessed, sitting in boxes. They'd just been hauled from somebody's closet where they'd been sitting for 30 or 40 years. And so I worked as a volunteer at One, helping them organize these letters. But as soon as I found them, I realized, oh, here's my dissertation. And so I spent the next 10 years thinking about them and writing about them, and everything you just heard was floating in my head for 10 years, and it's so nice that everyone gets to hear it now, and everyone gets to hear, you know, think about these letters.
So could you talk a little bit about the political environment? I mean, I know that the letters were written in. I know that some of the people in the audience who actually lived it, like I did. But I think that it would be really nice for you to talk a little bit about the, as it's published in your book, especially the U.S. postal surveillance, panic defense, arrest, surveillance.
Well, if you're not gay or lesbian, I don't think most people realize how much the Cold War and McCarthyism really targeted gay people. I mean, I think most of us know this, but people outside of the community really have no clue that you know, more than twice as many gays and lesbians lost their government jobs during the 50s compared to people who were just left-wing or potentially communist. I mean, there were more gay victims than the Red Scare than communists were. And it impacted every aspect of life. You know, it's kind of, D.C. is kind of the epicenter, but it ripples across the country. Police agencies across the country are sort of enforcing the laws a little bit more because there's this paranoia about it. And it impacted people's jobs and employment more than anything. I'd say of you know, all the letters I read, and I used about 1,000 in Masked Voices, and there's about 125 in Letters to One, jobs and employment was the issue that came up the most often. It was the one thing that they're talking about more than anything else. I am worried about losing my job. And that was where, especially for people who worked for the government, but especially for people who worked for government-contracted private companies, which, of course, in Southern California, the defense industry, that's a lot of people. So there are these ripples of anxiety, you know, circulating through a lot of the country, but especially Southern California in the late 40s and early 50s. And that's the context in which, you know, first the Mattachine came along, and then One was the second big gay rights organization, really kind of against McCarthyism.
So, Zsa Zsa, we're going to share a microphone here, but I wanted to ask you to talk about how this climate in your reading of the letters was evidenced and how you were thinking about the historical climate in the way that you approached creating Dear One?
Right. Oh, I have one.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You have your own.
Well, wow. My favorite Martian.
Sorry.
Well, first of all, I have to say that we all owe a huge debt to Craig for the many hours of sitting in an archive mining and mining to bring these letters back to life. So thank you.
Thank you.
I couldn't do my part unless Craig had first done the very hard pick and axe work that he did. And I have a great appreciation for that. You're welcome. Let me just say this, that the letters are extraordinary. And they're often very, very long. So what you heard was just in most instances, was just a small piece of the letters. And I worked hard to, you know, just take the very essence, the very heart of each letter. So if you want to read the full letters, and they are extraordinary documents, I absolutely suggest Craig's book, because there you can get the full sense of it. It's an extraordinary time. Of course, looking at these letters, I had to do a lot of research independently. And as Craig said, we don't have an understanding of how severe the Lavender Panic was. I mean, throughout everything I read about McCarthy and his minions, and he had several senators who were doing his hatchet work, and he particularly stayed on the Red Menace cant, and he left his senators to do the Lavender Menace business. It's supposed by some historians that it's because he was gay, and he didn't want to get too closely involved in that and put the spotlight on himself. But that's really something, the Lavender Menace. Wow. And we talked a lot about that, the cast and I, about that, because it's just woven throughout this terrible, terrible panic, and communism equals homosexuality, and homosexuality equals communism. It's really extraordinary. And so we worked very carefully to take, you know, the heart of each letter. I don't know that that answers your question.
It's a great answer.
Thank you. I have a short memory.
Craig, back to you. I wanted to ask you a little. I know that you've talked about this oppression a lot. We've talked about oppression a lot and how this affected folks' lives. But I also know that you see a really light end to this, too, that instead of just oppression, there's an awfully great sense of humor that people exhibited. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you heard it. I mean, you guys were laughing. The letters, some of them are really funny, you know. I wasn't expecting that, sitting down reading the letters. I was expecting them to all be just completely depressing and total bummers. And there were some, you know, that kind of conformed to a very victim-y approach to being gay in the 50s, wallowing in self-pity. But the further I got into the letters and the more I read them, there was just, even in the letters describing really tragic things, there was a silver lining or an upbeat tone or a resilient tone or a sense of humor in the face of it. Humor as defiance. You know, I think gay people probably, maybe more than other minority groups, have really used humor as a weapon. But, you know, biting wit and satire, and it comes through. And to me, it signified resilience and adaptation. And so I went into the letters thinking, okay, here's a bunch of victims. And when I read them and really was writing about them, I'm realizing they didn't think of themselves as victims. Mm-hmm. You know, they're being victimized, but they are, you know, I think, yeah, chin up. And like one of the letters said, chin up and eager to fight. And this was when it started, you know, and way before Stonewall.
Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing, too, about those defiant letters, we have to remember that that era, if you were discovered, you would lose your house, lose your job, you'd lose the respect of your community. You might have to just go to a whole different city and start over. And so that those letters that are proud and defiant, I'm not the sex psychopath that science tells me I am. I'm a good person with a role to play in the world. I think of Barry, Barry, you know, you can print my name. I am not afraid, and I do not lead a double life.
Plus, it was against the law.
Right.
You know, people forget that. I tell my students, it used to be against the law. And they, like, look at me like they can't believe that, you know? They're dumbfounded that, you know, they're talking about marriage. That's where all their heads are at, you know, like the 20-year-olds. And they can't even imagine a time when it was illegal to be gay or lesbian and you could go to jail just for walking into the wrong space.
Yeah.
So do any of you have questions that you'd like to pose to...
Some microphones right there.
Yes.
You answered this to some extent in your very last letter when you had the response from one, but I kept wondering what happened to these letters. Did one respond? Obviously, there were so many needs. So I was just wondering what happened in response. Thanks.
Most of the letters that I read did have a carbon copy response with them, and most of the responses were written by the same guy, someone who spent many, many hours at a typewriter. And the responses are somewhat formulaic. They offered help when they could. A lot of times they couldn't. I have to say the guy who responded to the letters, his name was Dore Legg, a legendary early gay rights activist in LA. The responses get a little crankier over the years. In the early years, he's much more sympathetic and, oh, I feel so sorry. But by like 57 or 58, he's like, come on, do something about this. Don't just wallow in self-pity, you know? And he's a little snappy towards them. So a lot of people got some maybe more snappy responses than they were expecting. Some people actually wrote back saying, you wrote a very mean reply to me. How dare you, you know, insult my feelings like that. You know, I think like the Janus Society helping that guy, that was a Philadelphia organization. As the letters go on, you see more of that also. In the early years, one really didn't have the resources network to really give people very practical help. But by 1960 or so, they had a list of lawyers. There were other organizations. There were other people they could say, oh, contact this person. So increasingly over time, the responses get a little more helpful, I think. Generally not, no. Sometimes they would say, oh, we'll tell you more, but can you send in a donation? They were always trying to get money, so they would attach info with money. So the organization was usually broke, and so they did anything they could to get money.
It's also really funny because as the person who does the tours around the building on a regular basis, one of the things that I find is when we go into our serials room where all the publications, the serial publications like magazines and things are kept, that's actually where the emotion starts to come out at one because for many people, one was a lifeline when there was nothing else there. And it really is, people actually get emotional in that room. Oh my God, do you have anything from Kansas? And then I'll take them there and they'll say, oh my God, you have no idea what this meant to me. This really, really was the only place that I could go. So it really changed a lot of people's lives.
Next question over here.
There was a hint in one of the letters that women were able to pass much more successfully than men. And I wonder if, given Mr. Lofton, your examination of the archives, if you found that to be true. And if paradoxically, the Lavender Menace put more pressure on straight men to really try and avoid the taint of homosexuality.
To start with your second question, absolutely. There's a colleague in my department named John Ibsen who's written a whole book about photographs of men and how an awareness of homosexuality in society and specifically the paranoia, men no longer are being photographed touching each other. You know, like look at old photographs of men, they're all over each other. And then right around 1940 or 50, you know, like team photos and fraternity photos. And so, yeah, you see that in a lot of different ways. As far as whether women were better at passing than men, I can't say any, you know, thing too precise about that, except that the majority of people were trying to pass because their survival depended on it. And I think historically, women maybe are a little less suspected generally, but case by case, I think the women felt at least as much pressure and as much anxiety. The sense I got from the letters, and there were a lot fewer from women than men, was that they were certainly as worried about being discovered as the men were. So they would have put as much energy, if not more, into the process of passing as straight. Whether they're better at it or not, who knows?
And if I can just add to that just a little bit, there's a really great letter in our collection, or an interview too, with Donna Smith, who tells a story about wanting desperately to wear men's pants. So when she would go to rent parties that men would hold, she'd run to their closet, put on their pants, and run around the apartment. So I think that that speaks to that ability, whether or not you could or could not pass, and the oppressive feeling that women had. The other thing I'll tell you is I found recently that there was actually a movement in the 1940s to make Jesus more butch, and that there was a feeling that female Sunday school teachers were in fact feminizing Jesus to the point where that Christians wanted to make sure that he was a little bit more a carpenter.
And there's one right there also.
Hi, I have the honor of working with Dr. Craig Lofton at Cal State Fullerton. And just as one served as a kind of place of comfort for people when it was currently in circulation, he told me a story about the Kindle version of his book and its worldwide appeal. And if you have the time, I'd love you to tell us about the letter you got because of your one book from Africa.
There's a little Facebook page for Mass Voices, and somebody just posted something from, it was a woman from Kenya, just saying, you know, how hard her life was. This is like a year ago, you know, just that she doesn't feel safe, and that she's being persecuted, and that people around her are disappearing. I was shocked to receive this, obviously, very moved by it, but also felt so absolutely helpless, you know, and I could just write some glib things to her, but, you know, I mean, what these people are going through in the 50s, it's worse other places right now, you know, and much of the planet right now, and we have to always remember that it's worse than, it's worse there now than it was in the 50s here. It's life or death. In the 50s, you'd lose your job, you'd lose your career, you'd lose your reputation. But I probably don't need to tell you what's going on in Uganda and everywhere else. Yeah.
Question right over here.
I wonder if a possibility of some kind of a supplement at some point, if you have heard or might heard from any of those who've sent the letters. I assume some would still be alive in terms of what's happened to them in their lives since then.
Many of them actually became members of one and are still working with us. I hear from people who subscribed. In fact, we've received generous gifts from folks because of their thanks for what we've done over the years. So yeah, there's and I hear a lot of stories from people about how one really helped them to survive in a time that was really terrible. So yeah, we hear that all the time. They're all different stories, but we hear them all the time.
Can you take two more questions? One right over here.
Thank you. Hi, I was particularly moved by that one letter, the woman who, I guess, seemed like she was transgendered.
That's how I read it, yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you, that must have been doubly hard back then to have to deal with that. I wonder if you had any more letters from people that were going through that same thing as well.
It wasn't something that was talked about very much. There was one issue of one that they devoted to what we would call transgender now. Not sure what word they were using then, but it was on their radar, but it was a very small blip. Let me just tell you one thing, though. This past semester at Fullerton, I got to teach a LGBT kind of history class in the American Studies department, and I assigned letters to the students, and that letter had the biggest impact of all of them. I went around the room, asked them what letter lingers in your mind, and that one, several of them were like, I just couldn't stop thinking about that, and the experience of the confusion, just that sense of lonely, isolated confusion that a transgender person in the 50s or 60s must have been thinking about, and it's a little frightening to, I think, theatrically inhabit that.
Yeah, I love what Dalila did. I love, when you think of transgender personages in the 50s, I think perhaps you think of Christine Jorgensen. But I don't believe her autobiography came out until the 1960s. So, yes, I love that letter. And it was the only letter that I saw that was even remotely transgender.
Yeah, it was really the only one I came across that really you could put the T label on. But, yeah, mostly just gay men mostly, you know.
Next question here.
One quick comment. Maybe you also want to talk about just the question of passing for lesbians, whether they're butch or not. But the one thing I wanted to ask was, Zsa-Zsa, could you talk about what is next for this marvelous work of art that you've created?
Wow, thank you. We just had an invitation to appear at something called the Pop-Up Bookstore. In downtown Los Angeles, well, I guess that's where we are, July 17th at 8 p.m., and I'll post something about that, yeah. I've never, ever heard of it, but it's something where there's a literary event. It's sponsored by some small publishing houses, a literary event, one each night for 90 days. So I don't quite know where it will be held. It has been described to me as a rooftop restaurant somewhere in Los Angeles. So it'll be very interesting. It's a small house, 50 people, and more will be revealed.
All right, then. So I want to thank everyone who joined us here today, especially Zsa-Zsa for putting this wonderful work together. Again, let's hear it for the cast of Dear One. And for Craig for giving us all a reason to move on this. I also want to mention to you, just a shameless plug, that One has an event later on this evening from 6 to 9. We're programming crazy lately. I don't know what it is. At our West Hollywood Gallery, if you've never been there, it's behind the new West Hollywood Library. We have an exhibition that's entitled The Classical Nude and the Making of Queer History, and it features works from the Leslie Lohman Museum in New York. And if you want to come and see us about anything, you can always look at one.org or one.usc.edu. Either one of those will give you all the information about what we're doing at any given time. And then we'd love to have you around. So please come down, do a tour, any of that sort of stuff. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for being here. Go sell some books.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.